1115 West Windsor Road in Champaign, featuring an international selection of wines, beer, and spirits, plus a gourmet deli and Café Soleil, serving a lunch and light dinner menu. More information on the web at sunsingerwines.com. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, what American artists of the 20th century have had to say about America through their work. That is the subject of the documentary, Imagining America. Our guest this afternoon is University of Illinois art professor Jonathan Feinberg. Professor Feinberg and John Carlin are the creators of the film Imagining America, Icons of 20th Century American Art. The documentary can be seen on PBS stations around the country this month. It's set to air on the 28th. Of December. And on our companion station, you can see it at 8 p.m. on the 28th. A companion book by the same title is also available. The publisher, Yale University Press. The film and book examines three basic questions. How do American artists represent the world around them? How do American artists represent themselves? And how do American artists help us understand how mass media has transformed our sense of self and society? Listeners, I invite your questions about American art of the 20th century for Jonathan Feinberg. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome.
Well, thanks for asking me.
It's been a while since we've seen one another.
I know, but it's always a pleasure.
Thank you. In one of the archival interviews in the film, William de Kooning talks about slipping into a glimpse, slipping into the glimpse. He says, "You could call me a glimpser." Does that get at the essence of the work of artists?
Well, of course, every artist is a little different, but I think that yes, in a very important way, he calls himself a slipping glimpser because I think the artist is always using their work to explore the reality of their experience. And frequently what's new about that experience is something for which we don't really have a verbal vocabulary yet. So artists are, in a sense, finding forms that correlate with their experience of the world. And as they find those forms and bring them into relationship to each other, they are literally getting glimpses of the future and of the present, which feel new and are very exciting for them. And, of course, that's what makes them so incredibly important for the rest of us.
Yeah, I think Robert Rauschenberg talks about working in the hole between the space. That's what how he refers to it.
Yeah, he talks about that the space between a work of art and reality, because what he's saying is that the work of art isn't reality, but it's somehow related to reality, and it's in that, as he says, that space in between that he works. And that, of course, as he said, that's what makes the adventure of painting, and that I think is true for de Kooning as well.
Yeah. What sets apart the glimpsing, if we can use that word, of 20th century America from the century that preceded it?
Well, I think artists, the work that artists do is always related to the reality of their circumstances. So artists are always trying to bring coherence to their experience. And if you're an American artist, it's an American experience. And it's also, it also belongs to your particular moment in history or your particular locality. So in that sense, of course, American artists are going to be different. And I think that actually, one of the things that set me off on this project was when I went to the Whitney Museum in 2000 and saw the American Century show, and I realized how much, in that case, I was particularly struck with Stuart Davis, who was cast as a kind of failed cubist. And I thought to myself, they don't understand what's interesting about Stuart Davis. And the reason they don't understand it is because they've imposed the structure of thinking about modern art in terms of modernism onto American artists. And it began to be clear to me that modernism is really a European movement, and it depends upon a kind of social hierarchy in Europe that we don't have and have never had. And I began to think, you know, postmodernism is what we call it now, which is this kind of unanchored ability to reinvent ourselves all the time, is something that has been with us for more than 200 years, that it's really the American contribution to the 20th century is postmodernism, not modernism. And I began to realize that, in answer to your question, that there is a dialogue with the realities of how we see ourselves in the world and what our culture, what's unique about our culture that's embedded in this work.
Yeah. Well, Georgia O'Keeffe says something to the effect of, no one could tell me how to paint a landscape, but she, that's where she started. She wanted to be taught. And what she discovered is that she had to find that for herself. So she not only found her way of painting the landscape, but she also found her own landscape. Yes?
Yes. I think that, of course, Georgia O'Keeffe, there's a bit of rhetoric involved in this, too. You know, she is, I think, aware that she's talking to an audience here. But yes, it's certainly true that all through Georgia O'Keeffe's career, from the very first time that she sends a letter to her friend Anita Politzer and with a bunch of drawings to take to Stieglitz, you know, she says, you know, I finally found that I needed to forget everything I was taught, to stop painting all the things that fitted into the way people painted before me, and to find the things that are my own. And that was certainly a leitmotif in her whole career. And in a sense, it's a realization of any mature artist, is that you need to paint what is authentically your perception.
Yeah. There's a wonderful story, even though I know that she was a great showwoman. But, you know, she's working at a point in New York City, and she's with all these men. And Stieglitz is her husband, and she says in the film, you know, they're all talking about the great American this and that, the great American novel, yada, yada, yada. So she says she quietly made her own statement, and that is Cow's Skull, Red, White, and Blue.
Yes, when you see some of these clips of Georgia O'Keeffe talking, you just fall in love with her because she's funny and she's so smart and irreverent in a way about all of this. But but that painting, which is in the Metropolitan Museum, is, one of the great icons of 20th century American art. And she makes the comment. She said, I decided to make this painting an American painting, and I painted red stripes down the side, so it was red, white, and blue. And she sort of laughs and she says, I don't think anybody else caught on to this for quite a while.
But it tickled her.
She was having a good time, right?
Yeah. What would you like to say about the insider insights a new work of art offers us?
Well, there are so many things I could say about that. That's a huge topic. And I think that people who watch this film or read this book will I hope they're going to start with the artists that they know well, like George O'Keefe and Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol. And I hope they'll begin to see the depth with which these artists have really engaged the reality of their moment and of their culture. And with each of them, it's a different problem, of course, because the times are different and their particular insights are unique to them. But I think someone like Warhol, for example, who is at first sight you think he's playing games with you or he's just being difficult or whatever, but you watch him handle interviewers. That's one of the fascinating things in this film is we kept coming back to these interviews with Andy Warhol and you began to realize how incredibly in control he is. He knows exactly what he's doing. It's very deliberate. And he really teaches us how to read the media.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that after you watch, and also you realize the seriousness of the questions. It's not a game. This is a serious investigation of his own mortality. This is a man who's very worried about death and is thinking about the human condition in a profound way. And what does it mean to be an individual in a world which is so dominated by media and mass culture? And he really gives us a new vocabulary for looking at that question, as artists always do. Artists literally give us form for things which we don't have words to discuss yet. And Warhol takes us through the traces, so to speak, and confronts us with these things. The other aspect of this that's worth mentioning is that the artists who really have profound insight of some kind are often unpleasant to look at. And it's tough for people to understand that that's an important part because we all, in some sense, intuit what's being discussed, and often it's something that we don't want to talk about. We kind of sense it. It's a little threatening or it's uncomfortable to look at, and artists go right to that, and they make that their subject. And we have a lot to gain by taking a kind of an empathic leap and trying to understand the structure that they've given to these insights because we can use them ourselves.
Yeah. I was struck by the intensity and the power of Pollock, Jackson Pollock, and how I wonder what it would be like to be within close physical proximity of the man. You know, I think he would have been, that would have been tough. I mean, he almost vibrates in the film.
Yes. Well, Grace Hartigan in the film made a comment about that, and I think it's quite right and certainly fits with other things that I've read by people in saying that he was the most tormented person that she'd ever known. And it is often true, you know, that great artists are not necessarily attractive people. They can be difficult, hard. I mean, George O'Keefe's another example. She was tough to deal with. She was very demanding. She was manipulative. She was really mean to some people. But she was a great artist and a brilliant woman. And the same is true of all these major artists that we've talked about, whether it be, you know, Pollock or others. These were not always easy people. Some of them are wonderful to be around, but you know, just like every, you know, any cross section of people, you do find difficult people and easier people. But that's not the basis on which you judge what they did.
Yeah, well, the work is challenging, and if it's not challenging, I don't think it holds up, right?
Absolutely.
And I wonder what it would have been like to see Jackson Pollock in Jackson Pollock's day. Because we know those images now, same with Warhol. What was it like to be one of the first people to come across that artist doing that particular type of art?
Well, I think Grace was great about that. She was a contemporary, and she knew him well. She was one of the younger women in that circle. And she said the first time she walked into that studio and saw drip pictures on the floor wet for the first time, she said, I just didn't know what to say. It was flabbergasting to her. And I think it's fascinating because even with an artist like that, you know, Grace Hartigan's a very sophisticated artist working in a very sophisticated art world, and she walks in there and is speechless. And I think it's because there is, on the one hand, a recognition of the content, and on the other hand, you're faced with a vocabulary that's so new that there's really no framework to talk about it exactly, and you have to build that.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting to hear Pollock and other artists and the art historians that are featured in the film and in the book speak about Pollock's work. It is so physical. When he made it, it was a physical act. There was a lot of movement. And what he was doing was he's trying to put on canvas an expression of his inner self. And it, at once it's controlled, and at the same time, it's an exploration. So it's spontaneous and controlled. And I thought of, you know, how jazz musicians improvise. They're not just playing willy-nilly. It's within a discipline, but it's doing it in a new way.
Well, you know, that's one of the issues. I think you're absolutely right, and it's one of the issues that we took the opportunity to get into in a serious way in the book that we just didn't have the material to do in the film. We talked a lot about Louis Armstrong and the notion of the invention of the solo in the context of a band, and we talked a great deal about Charlie Parker also and the invention, and you realize how incredibly structured and how practiced that is. And you know, I thought one of the wonderful things about doing this project, the film in particular, was I went around and I took a camera crew and I interviewed some of the most articulate living American artists, some of the really great figures who are alive today, because it is my feeling that it's living artists who keep the history of art alive. And everybody goes to them and asks them to talk about their own work, but rarely do people ask them to talk about the history of art. So with each one of them, I said, okay, here are the ground rules. We're not talking about your work. We're talking about the history of art, and I want you to engage with me on this subject. And some of the things people said were just breathtaking because the insight was so profound. And I thought one of the people who was great talking about Pollock's method was Carrie Marshall, who was just this absolutely brilliant artist who lives in Chicago, and whose work doesn't look anything like Pollock in one sense, but when you really look at his work, you realize how much he has learned from Pollock. He's really digested Pollock. But he made the point, which I think is correct, is that after the first drip painting is made, he said, if you're using the same materials and the same technique, everything after that is plotted, so to speak. And he said, you watch Pollock make these paintings, and we have a lot of film footage here of Pollock working, which is interesting, I think, for people to see. You watch Pollock making a drip picture, and as Carrie says, you know, it's like watching a dancer who's practiced this choreography with real care and has extraordinary control in the end. And as Carrie says, you know, that's not just spontaneous anymore; it's mastery. That's what mastery is. It's taking the subject matter and really structuring it, pursuing it, exploring the language of how to discuss it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Armstrong and Bird. You know, they took the scales, they took the techniques, they took the instruments, and then they ran with them. But you know, it was mastery.
It was mastery, and you know, in the case of Charlie Parker, for example, just to take that example, if you listen to Charlie Parker carefully, you realize what he's appropriated. There are bits of folk music in there. There's operas. There's all kinds of things that he's picked up and used in his work. And you know, that's a curious thing, and it fits right into what I was saying before about the Americanness of this. And that is that he is willing to go to a whole range of sources without any sense of hierarchy about what's high art and what's low art, and you know what you can appropriate and can't appropriate. He goes for the things that speak to him, and he puts them into a relation with each other that's new. He, in effect, reinvents a context for them. And what that does in the process is it also unanchors them from the meaning that they had before to some extent. So it's really transforming them. Mm. And that sense of reinvention is something that came, I think, really struck me when I began to think about what was so unique about America in the 20th century, what made it, in a sense, the American century, to use Henry Luce's metaphor, and it is that kind of protean ability to reinvent ourselves all the time. And I think, you know, if you think back to even the founding fathers, there is something in the American polity which has this kind of abstraction to it. You know, we didn't just take all the laws that laws that were functioning by tradition at that moment. We sat down and said, okay, what are the rules and how should they be? And we created an ideal structure, and then we decided that was the law. And in a way, that's replicated in our monetary system, which really isn't based on gold. It's based on a promise. And it's really – so there's a kind of abstraction in the American – in American history, which has been there for a long time, this sense of somehow creating an idealized structure and reinventing ourselves in response to the reality of the present. It's certainly even true of our, you know, of our history. I mean, if you dig a hole in Europe, anywhere in Europe you dig a hole, you're going to run into some ancient foundation. In America, you get dirt. And, you know, that was a real issue, especially for the era of the founding fathers when Peale, for example, discovered mastodon bones on the banks of the Hudson. I don't know if you're familiar with this famous painting called The Exhumation of the Mastodon. This great painter and naturalist discovered these mastodon bones, and he excavated them on the banks of the Hudson, and he made a painting, which is a great American painting of himself standing with this long stream of paper on the bank of the Hudson with this drawing on it, and this incredible Rube Goldberg device, which is constructed to get this skeleton out of the ground. And when he was finished with that, and he brought this back to his kind of his Museum of Natural History that he created, well, guess who came knocking on his door? Jefferson really wanted those bones. And, you know, it had to do with this sense of wanting to find some kind of an American past. It was a very a powerful and very important issue because we had this great natural landscape, but we didn't have a continuous past. We had to jump back to kind of prehistoric times in a way to find something that was really uniquely American in the past. And so that also unanchored us in a very strange way. So all those pieces from the ancient past could be rearranged and reconfigured in a rather free way too.
Hmm. Now, the film begins with a work from the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
a painting by Thomas Cole, The Oxbow. Maybe you would give us here a sense of the content of that painting and tell us why you selected that painting as a departure point.
Well, this film has, in a sense, three chapters or three sections to it. And the three sections have to do with basic questions about a worldview. And they are, where am I, who am I, and how do I talk about my experience, basically. And this first chapter, which is about nature, is there really an American sense of nature, begins with Thomas Cole. And Thomas Cole is the inventor of the Hudson River School. He invents the first American landscape style. The second chapter is about identity, and the third chapter is about language. And each one of those chapters, what we wanted to do was, when John and I talked through this, and we've been talking about this for a long time, we wanted to go back into the 19th century to kind of early conceptions of some of these themes or formulations of these themes and bring them up into the present. So with the chapter on nature, we started with Cole, and we came all the way up to Robert Smithson in the end of the film. We superimposed them. You were mentioning that before we started today. Mm-hmm. When we talk about Pollock's gesture painting, we start really with Thomas Aikens, and we talk about, well, what does it mean to make a self-portrait, and in what ways was that reconceived in an American context? And, you know, with Aikens, the fascinating thing is the self-portrait in Aikens is not really a likeness anymore. He puts himself off in little roles in different places. He's way back in the distance in a boat, or he's swimming toward the rock with all the students on it. What's really the self-portrait in the Aikens is not the likeness. It's the structure of the painting. You are seeing the structure of his mind putting these pieces into a coherent relationship with each other. That's the self-portrait. It's the mind at work. And if you follow, and what we wanted to do in that chapter, for example, was to trace that idea, which is a really revolutionary idea, forward up to the point of Jackson Pollock, where Pollock basically eliminates representation altogether and creates this kind of map of his spontaneous emotional structures in his head, and it's brilliant. And he's able to convey the power of that self-portrait in gesture with no representation at all. With Cole, you know, a lot of the issues that when we want to talk about nature and really is there an American sense of nature that's different, Cole was a great place to start because, you know, that painting is 1836, and it was a period when we were already past the point of thinking about nature as this very dangerous, threatening, external thing and starting to worry about preserving it. We were already starting to think about conservation because people could see that we were starting to cultivate the land, and as we did that, we were losing what was kind of, at that time, many people thought of as God's nature. And that's the issue for Cole here. He talks about the iron tramp of civilization just wiping out this kind of Eden that had been created on the American continent. And when you look at this painting, that painting is divided right in half, and he has a self-portrait of he's sitting there with his easel right on that division line between cultivated nature and wild nature. And it's really about issues which will come back. You can trace those kinds of issues and the American perspective on those issues up to somebody like Robert Smithson, who in the early 1970s builds this spiral jetty in the Great Salt Lake. And it's all about the idea that, you know, industry is laying waste to the land and we're all these things that humans are doing to nature, that in the end, that's nature too, that we are part of nature. And the destruction we're doing is part of the natural process too. And it's another twist on this issue and makes us look at it with a kind of startling freshness, which is, of course, what's so great about artists is they take an issue that's right in front of your face that you're not seeing and put it right there and say, look at this.
Yeah. Well, with both these examples, if you take Cole and you move up through Smithson and Warhol, you not only have a celebration of America. I don't know where I'm going with this exactly, but you have this. You have hope, but yet you also have, you know, somebody blowing a whistle a little bit and saying maybe not even a little bit, but serving as a cultural or a societal conscience.
Yes. I think it's the nature of new insight and new discovery that it has both sides. And it's certainly the nature of artistic talent, too, that it has both sides. You know, there's the destructive side and the creative side, and there's always this kind of yin and yang. I think when we look at really revolutionary works of art, we do see the world in a new way. And some of the things we see are the potential for things that we can do, how great the future may be in some respects. And we also see all the dangers that are thrown in our face. And I think that, you know, that's throughout all of this. And I think it's also, in a way, a mirror of the struggle of the artist, her or himself. That is, when you look at some of those paintings of, I was thinking just yesterday about Picasso's works of around 1930, you know, when Nazism is on the rise, we're starting to see the march toward World War II. It's a difficult period. And in Picasso's work, he suddenly focuses on the Minotaur. And he's taking, this is getting away from our subject here, I guess, but it's true of all artists in a way that there is, on the one hand, he sees the power of his creative force. And he sees it as both this kind of endearing, almost victimized animal in the bull ring, and at the same time this terrifying image, which is always on the verge of out of control. And one of the things that artists have to do in order to really make work that is going to have this kind of a profound impact is they do have to take themselves right up to the edge. They have to take themselves to that area where the unconscious mind is out of control, where things are exposed in a way they're not supposed to be exposed. And all the things that we do in a civilized way to get along with one another, they have to transgress that to some extent in order to really deal with what's happening that's new in our social and our historical reality.
Maybe you would talk now about Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Well, Basquiat's a fantastic example. I mean, really a great artist. It's a tragedy that he had such a short career. But boy, what did he do in the time that he had? He's somebody who had an extraordinary gift for just laying on paint. He has Pollock's gift for laying on paint. It's remarkable. The paintings are just so beautiful, and they're so rich physically and gesturally, and they really, you know, there's a kind of bodily sense about them that's really fantastic. But at the same time, he was very sophisticated about the media. He and Andy Warhol were friends. They even collaborated on some works together, although, of course, Warhol was much older. So he was very alert to that. He was very interested in reproduction. He was interested in the implications. He loved to play with a Xerox machine. A lot of his works have Xeroxes in them. And then he would take Xeroxes and make Xeroxes of those and kind of reproduce things multiple times. And he does it with words, too. So when you look at a mature painting by Basquiat, it's got all these different kinds of semiotic levels in it at once. There are all kinds of languages that are overlaid on each other. Things are going in different directions at the same time. It really speaks to the complexity of the modern world in which things don't cohere in straight lines anymore. We're all now aware of that. The world seems simpler when we thought things worked in straight lines. And he's an artist who helped us to see how complex that is, how layered it is, how contradictory and at the same time continuous these things are. So he uses appropriation and he uses reproduction and he also uses this incredible sense of gesture and language.
Yeah. Well, it gets us to the issue of media and how we've moved now from coal and that landscape to another landscape altogether, and that is of information. And we are, as you point out in the book and in the film, a visual culture now.
Yes, we live in a landscape of signs, because so much of the world that we perceive now comes to us through some kind of mediated image in television, on computers, through books and magazines, all kinds of ways, not to speak of the fact that the very language that we use already is a filter and already allows us or presses us to describe things in a particular way, and then that changes how we see them. So we all have had the experience, if you speak another language, you know that there are some things you just can't translate, and it's because the language itself shapes the character of the experience of that thing.
Yeah, and the visual language, I think we're still grappling with how to sort through it.
Yes, it's a very serious issue for educators, I think. It's one of the things I've been thinking about a great deal. I would say probably in the late 1950s already, or certainly by 1960, we had made a transition from a text-based culture to a visual culture. And we are still now almost 50 years later in most of our university courses worried about verbal literacy, and nobody's teaching visual literacy. And I'm beginning to see, I mean, in some places like Harvard University, which is supposed to be the, you know, flagship university, they don't even have an art department. They're at least 100 years out of date in terms of the education they're offering their undergraduates. We do much better here. But and I think we're doing better still as we begin to think about this consciously, which we are doing. It's one of the great things, I think, about the kind of new breath of the new administration that's come into this university. I think they're very sophisticated about these things, and they're starting to think about how we structure that kind of an education. But we need to learn to read signs. And one of the messages of this film and of this book is that there's a vocabulary and there's a syntax to visual imagery, and we understand our culture through visual images. And one of the things I wanted to do here, John and I really thought about a lot, was trying to create a portrait of American culture through our visual culture and to teach people a little bit how to read imagery and how to read the visual environment that they're in.
Yeah, it's so critical. I mean, we could be steamrolled by this if we don't try to understand it and peel back the layers and the meanings.
And the implications are so pervasive. I mean, I think about it in terms of how public schools work. You know, we have for a long time been assuming that we should be teaching students on a kind of linear model, a verbal linear model. And now all of a sudden it's beginning to dawn on us that there are many ways of learning, different styles of learning, and that we probably shouldn't be privileging one over the other, and that some of the most creative people in our society are people who don't function on those linear models. And when I think about – it's one of the revelations to me is to look at who are the most brilliant and creative people in our society and where do they get educated and how. And many of them are people who – they went to state schools or they went to junior colleges. Many of them didn't graduate. Frequently you find people who are brilliant who just don't fit the old-fashioned paradigms. Well, we are starting to think mm-hmm. about that, and we're changing the rules now, and it's about time.
Yeah. I also think it is showing us that we need to appreciate other cultures that have not been linear, that go way, way back in time.
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, that also is certainly true. It's just a more open world in a sense. And I think that's, you know, when we talk about postmodernism, I think that's really what it has to do with. It has to do with the acceptance that there are multiple different directions in meaning and in thought, that things that happen simultaneously, that it isn't just one direction or one point of view. It's lots of different points of view. And of course, you know, the multiculturalism of America, which has been there for hundreds of years, is also – it's built into our kind of definition of who we are, because for – I mean, if you read the stories about what it was like to be in New York at the turn of the century, it's in a way like it is today. You walk down the street, you hear multiple languages. There are people who are constantly – no one can take for granted that their way of seeing things is going to be the prevailing thing, because you are constantly having to negotiate. And it's I think it's one of the things that has contributed to this kind of sense of reinvention that we have and the adaptability that has made Americans such a powerful culture in the 20th century.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, University of Illinois Art Professor Jonathan Feinberg. Professor Feinberg and John Carlin are the creators of the film Imagining America, Icons of 20th Century American Art. The documentary can be seen on PBS stations around the country this month. It will air on December 28th here in our part of the world. It will be shown on WILL-TV on December 28th at 8 p.m. And what you heard there a moment ago with something flying across the table was our program guide, because I wanted to mention when it will be repeated. The first airing on WILL-TV Wednesday, December 28th at 8 p.m. Then it will be repeated midnight Thursday and 3 a.m. on Friday. So if you miss it on the 28th at 8 p.m., you can set up your recorder and record it. The film examines icons of 20th century American art and how art here in America shows us who we are and who we have been. To what extent are artists in conversation with one another over time? Let's take the city of New York, for example, and how Georgia O'Keeffe painted it, and Jean-Michel Basquiat, a New Yorker, a Brooklynite, how he negotiated the city. Two very different views.
Well, yes, I mean, it's not just on the level of the subject itself, but I'm not quite sure how I want to answer that one.
Yeah, I don't know how, for example, would somewhere in the collective culture, in our collective consciousness, would Robert Smithson be aware of Thomas Cole?
Oh, yes. And I think that, so, I mean, your question really had to do, I guess, with the way in which artists contribute to an ongoing dialogue
right.
with each other, and that certainly is crucial, because artists will learn from anything they see, and they're voracious. They have a voracious appetite for images always. So that's of course that's going on. It was fascinating to me to when I talked to these individual artists how much they were aware of and how articulate they were about past artists who I didn't quite expect. I had one great experience, for instance, with Ed Ruscha, who's really one of the greatest living artists from the pop art generation, the Los Angeles artist. And in his studio, we were sitting in the studio talking, and he had he was behind him, leaning against the wall, was one of his new paintings, which has the if you have seen his new work, it's they look almost like Swiss chocolate box pictures of snow-capped mountains, and they're absolutely symmetrical. He's playing with this whole idea of, you know, this kind of symmetry down the center and so on, with text written across it. And I remember the painting because it said "Hurry Up Schedule" on it in big white letters across this, you know, this mountaintop. And we were talking, and I said, "Have you ever looked at the paintings of Thomas Cole?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I love Thomas Cole," because and we started talking about The Course of Empire, which is a series of paintings that Cole made that are in the New York Historical Society. And he said, every time I go to New York, I go look at those paintings. I just love them. And I love the fact that all those different events, because there are multiple paintings, the different stages of the development of our civilization is really what it was about. But he said, I love the fact that all those things are happening on the same piece of land. Well, one of the things that Ed Ruscha is very famous for are a series of books in which he photographed all of the gasoline stations on Route 66 or all the parking lots on Sunset Strip or, you know, series of things. And he's very interested in that idea of serial imagery and coming back to the same pattern and looking at it in a different way and what that does to the image. You know, how does it change the gasoline station suddenly when you see 100 of them lined up? And so we started talking about that. And I said, well, did you ever look at the Oxbow? Because one of the things that I wanted to do when I constructed this film, I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to talk to 25 different artists and art historians, and we need to make this cohere somehow in the end to make a film out of this. So I tried to make myself a kind of a book of images, and I picked, say, 150 images that I wanted to talk about as representing the range of American art in the 20th century, thinking that I would have an example on my lap when I went to go talk to somebody, and it would end up with all these people using the same examples, which is what happened. And it was a great device. It just worked out very well. So I had in my lap this picture of the Oxbow. And I said, well, you know, did you ever look at the Oxbow? And he said, oh, yeah, I really know that. I'm interested in that picture. I said, did you ever notice in the back of the Oxbow, on the hill in the background, there are Hebrew letters inscribed into the hillside? And he stopped dead in his tracks and stared at me. He pulls this reproduction out of my lap and said, oh, man, now I really like him. Because, of course, he himself is really engaged in this whole idea of letters in the landscape and messages and the dissonance between the image and text and all of that. It's very important for Ruscha. So he's, you know, it's an issue that had already been there for him, and he found something in Cole here. Well, what happens a year and a half later? This last year at the Biennale, in the American Pavilion of the Biennale in Venice, I walk into the Biennale, and the exhibition is Ed Ruscha called The Course of Empire, and he's gone back to Cole and rethought the core idea of Cole, but of course done it in a completely different and brilliant way by taking sites that he himself had painted 10 years ago and painting what's on that site now. So that discourse is always going on, to answer your question.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. Caller on line one, good afternoon.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
What a great subject matter. And I was driving across town. I live in Urbana, and I was hoping I could get home in time to call you because I wanted to say I really appreciate what you're doing. Where can I start? We live in a As you're right, we live in a visual culture, and no one talks about images. I mean, if you know, you get the occasional thing on PBS or some art channel. I don't. Bravo used to try to pretend to be that, but no one talks about how these images were formed or created, or what their history is, and how they're interrelated. As you're discussing now with Cole's work, which are absolutely stunning paintings. If anybody gets a chance to see those, but I wanted to say you were talking earlier about Pollock. And I'm fascinated by his work, but years and years ago I used to teach a drawing class, and I took a slide of in the Sistine Chapel. There's the Last Judgment painting by Michelangelo, and I would take the slide back when you could do this, and I would turn it out of focus. I did it accidentally, actually, and I looked at it, and I said, my God, that looks like a Pollock painting. So I sort of put them together, and I had a professor friend who taught a subject called color field theory, which I don't know if he invented it or not, I doubt it, but it was this whole how colors are used in modern art. And also, when you were talking about words, I like Jasper Johns' work is loaded with numbers and words and all the there. I mean, it's just what an interesting subject. I'm really looking forward to seeing your film and reading your book. But I really want to emphasize to the listeners, if anybody is listening, that, you know, it's just amazing. You're bringing out such an interesting point. So few people. I mean, I have an extensive background in art, and art history, and studio work, and I love to just go to museums and see what's new, you know, and shows like that. But it just amazes me how we're surrounded by this, you know, hugely visual culture, and yet people look at it like, huh, you know. It's almost as if like they're taught not to be interested in it. And when you told me that, when you mentioned that Harvard didn't even have an art education class, I thought, well, that fits. You know what I mean? It just fits with that whole sort of, I'm so glad I got to talk to you. I just want to say that.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think it's interesting what you say. I mean, I do think that on some level, places like Harvard, which are a little kind of uptight places, I know because I went there, they're a little afraid of this content. It's a little too out of control. And it is, you know, when you're dealing with visual images, you're getting a lot closer to the realm of the unconscious that we normally don't make available to other people standing in the room with us. And I think that it's challenging content. It's uncomfortable sometimes because it feels very exposed. And I think that there is a kind of resistance, historical resistance to dealing with that.
Maybe it's because in part we don't want to look too closely, and we're more comfortable like leaving it as wallpaper rather than taking a closer look at it.
Yeah, denial. That's what it is.
We're out of time.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the afternoon magazine, Jonathan Feinberg. He and John Carlin are the creators of the film Imagining America, Icons of 20th Century American Art. There's a companion book by the same title available from the Yale University Press. And the film Imagining America airs December 28th on PBS stations across the country. On WILL-TV, it will air at 8 p.m. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, kind of a surprising day after USDA's release of the numbers this morning from the WASDE report, the World Agricultural and Supply Demand Estimates, which showed a carryover not only in the United States but globally growing for both corn and soybeans. Despite this fact, and the numbers were pretty big actually for the U.S., beans carryover up 55 million bushels to 405. That was up from 350 earlier. Corn up 100 million bushels to 2.419 billion bushels now in the carryover. That's what's expected to be in the cupboard by the time we get to next fall. That's up from 2.319. And they still managed to rally in the face of a growing carryover, not only here in the United States, but globally as well. The corn and the bean numbers on carryover were up for those two crops around the world. We'll talk with the folks at Risk Management Commodities Incorporated out of Lafayette, Indiana, about that at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock, not too far away this afternoon during the closing market report. In the mean space, December wheat at the Kansas City Board of Trade today traded 5.5 cents lower, had a high today of 353, a low at 351.5, a settlement price at 352. They were off 5.5 cents today. July futures, the harvest month there, down a nickel at 344, the high at 46, the low at 43. Dece wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade for the soft red winter wheat, 295 the high, the low at 292.5, a settlement price there at 293, and they were down 2.5 cents for the day. The carryover in the U.S. for the wheat was unchanged, by the way. The March contract, 310 the high, the low at 307, settlement price 307.5, down 4.75, and the May futures at 319.25 high, low 316.5, settled 317, down 4.25. July wheat down 3.75 today, 326.75 the final price. with a high of 28.5 and low at 25.5. December corn futures, 190 the high, the low down on the contract low at 186, 189 and three quarters. The settlement price, they were up a penny and a half after that little bounce. March contract trading below $2, new contract low there, but managed to rally back at the end of the day, had a high of 204, a low at 199.5, settled close to the high at 203 and three quarters. They were up two. May futures, 212 and three quarters the high, the low at 208 and three quarters. Settlement price at 212.5, a penny and three quarters higher. And July, 221.5, the high, the low at 217 and a quarter. July corn, 221 and a quarter, up 2.25 for the day. And December contract, Dave Dickey tells me, made a new low today as well for the contracts. 241 and three quarters the high, the low at 237 and three quarters. That's a new contract low for the red Deese corn, 241 and a quarter. Settlement price there, up 2.25. December oats, 214.5 the high, the low at 210. Settlement price at, on that low, unchanged for the day. And the March futures at 199 and three quarters high, low at 96.5, settled at 98 and three quarters. They were up a penny and a quarter for the day. Soy complex now, January beans, 570 the high, the low at 60, settlement price at 68 and three quarters, up 2 cents. March futures, 579 the high, the low at 68, settlement price at 578.5, up 3. And May beans, 583 the high, the low at 573, settled 582.5, up 2.75. July futures, 591 the high, the low at 80, settlement price at $5.90 a bushel. For the July beans, they were up 4 cents. August contract, 593.5 the high, the low at 84, settlement price at 93.25, up 8.25. And the November beans were up 7 cents for this coming year, 599 the high, the low at 88.25, settlement price at $5.98 a bushel, up 7 for the no beans 2006. Bean meal December contract, 181.60, a settlement up 230. The January's up 160 at 180.90. December bean oil, 2070, settlement price there down 27. January futures down 35 at 20.87. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
And the livestock contracts finish lower today. January feeder cattle 115.10, the high, the low 113.62.5, the settlement 113.77.5, that down $1. March 114.25, the high 112.75, the low 113.30, the settlement, that down 80. April 112.95, the high 111.30, the low, the settlement 112.10, that down 95. December live cattle 92.55, the high 91.75, the low 91.92.5, the settlement, that down 50. February 95.65, the high 94.45, the low, the settlement 94.52.5, that down 97.5. December lean hog 63.02.5, the high 62.42.5, the low 62.55, the settlement, that down 32.5. February 66.75, the high 65.80, the low 65.90, the settlement, that down 72.5. April 69.10, the high 68.35, the low 69 even, the settlement, that down a nickel. May 70.70, the high 70.20, the low 70.47.5, the settlement, that down 35. February bellies 86.50, the high 85.25, the low 86.20, the settlement, that up 10. The Dow is up 46 points at 10,801. The NASDAQ 12 higher at 22.59. The S&P 500 up 7 at 1263.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division.